Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're ready to hear argument in the case of Holden against Walter. Mr. Bertocci.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Joel Bertocci on behalf of Walsh Construction Company. The district court in this case certified two classes, an hours and overtime class, which I'll refer to as an overtime class, and a class on hostile work environment claims. With respect to the overtime class, our argument is simple. The policy on which the plaintiffs presented their case and on which the district court relied is indistinguishable from the one that the court found not to present common issues, questions of law or fact in the Walmart case. It is a policy exactly like Walmart's. It delegates authority over the issue of hours and overtime to local supervisors. They make those decisions on their own based on their own criteria. There is no guiding policy that applies class-wide. That is the only policy that was presented to the district court, and it is the policy the district court expressly relied on in certifying that class. The district court thought this case was more like this court's decision in McReynolds than Walmart. But that was a misreading of McReynolds. McReynolds identified two specific...
Let me ask you about the other, the hostile work environment.
Sure, Your Honor.
How would you feel about a class shrunken to the to the workers under the three foremen and the superintendent, the four alleged bigots at the workplaces that those the three foremen and the superintendent were present at during the complaint period?
Your Honor, I would feel better about that, certainly, but I would think that there would be issues with respect to that also. One of the issues would be that the standard for a hostile work environment. There are isolated incidents involving other sites, but really the only site where the plaintiffs presented any sort of nucleus of incidents is the Skybridge site.
Yeah.
And, you know, that obviously shrunken further would be more appealing.
How many workers were at Skybridge?
Your Honor, I'm not sure about that. I think there were probably laborers, which is what
right.
we covered.
Although,
actually, I'm not sure. The reason I'm not sure is that the hostile environment class covers all African-American employees and not laborers. I think there were somewhere in the area of 30 to 40 laborers at Skybridge, but I'm not positive about that. I'm not sure that the number was ever actually determined in the course of discovery.
Well, a similar question. Do we know what the size or approximate size of the class, of either class is?
As certified, Your Honor?
Yeah.
We're thinking it's around 700. 700 laborers at the 262 sites.
But is this just a hostile work environment?
No, I think, I should say that we think there are 700 laborers. So that would cover the overtime class and part of the hostile environment class. I don't think we know the number of non-laborer African-American employees who would be covered by the hostile work environment class.
Right.
In any event, Your Honor, an additional problem with a class like that would be that the anecdotes that they present, while certainly offensive, as they would be in any hostile environment case, did not rise to the level, even at Skybridge, of the sort of pervasive, humiliating, or threatening conduct that would alter someone's job description. So I think there are problems with even certifying a Skybridge class, but certainly that is the only place that the plaintiffs ever really took a run at presenting a description of an environment. I'll continue with that, with the point, the hostile work environment discussion. The district court recognized that the anecdotes that she had before her were very small compared to the size of the class she was being asked to certify, and she was able to bridge that gap in her mind by invoking what she called mobility or transferability of workers. The record doesn't support the use of this principle to get around the normal rules for certifying classes, particularly in multi-site cases. There is nothing in the record that reflects that the construction industry is so much more mobile than other parts of the economy. I suppose it's more mobile than lawyers or federal judges, but I think there are a lot of other sectors in the economy where you would find that people move around. In fact, the judge was not clear when she talked about transferability whether she was talking about transferability from Walsh job to Walsh job or just transferability in the construction industry. The laborers are union people. They get hired from job to job, and their next job might be for McHugh or another construction company that would have a different environment that certainly would not be attributable to Walsh.
Are they hired in hiring halls? Or?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think that's what happens. They get hired for a particular job. The district court, another problem with this transferability principle is that Judge Lefkoe never really explained how it works. She never said whether what she meant was, does it have to be this way, you know, that if these guys are bad, everybody else must be bad. If that's what she meant, that's barred by Walmart. She never said whether she was just saying that the class, that these people were bad wherever they went, as Judge Posner's question suggested. But if that's what she meant, certainly you wouldn't certify a 262-site class.
Do we know anything about the structure of the Walsh Company?
We know quite a bit, Your Honor. And there is a deposition attached, I believe, to document 142. I think it's Exhibit 5. Of a gentleman named Whalen who describes in about 16 pages of testimony the structure. Let me tell you a little bit about it. The company is divided into two divisions. One is the building division and the other is called the heavy highway division that does road-related projects. But each of those divisions has within it a half a dozen of what they call business groups. They might be called departments, depending on which words you like to use. And each of those has different kinds of sites under it. So in that, but the class that Judge Lefkoe certified, the 262 sites, come from all over the company. Now, if you have a high-rise project like Skybridge was that's being built by the high-rise division, and a block away you have a road-building site being built by a department in the heavy highways, they might as well be 1,000 miles apart because there's not going to be any common management until you get way up to the top of the company for that. So it's another reason you're going to have this organizational separateness. It's not like all these sites are very close together and managers run from one to the other. Somebody who builds high-rises is not going to be supervising a heavy highway job the next time. So the class, the sites themselves are too diverse, both because of their different nature and because they involve very separate business operations in the company. Ultimately, the scope
of
the...
Well, this concrete team, they go from site to site, right?
They do. The
do we know how large it is?
You know, I don't know for sure, Your Honor. I have the impression it's about 7 to 10 people at a time.
It's small. Yeah.
It's not a huge crew. It may vary in size if they have a bigger job, but it's not a massive job. And some of the specifics about the concrete team are important for two reasons. One is the concrete team goes to a job, pours some concrete, and then they move on. They're never at any job long enough to create a hostile environment that would satisfy the standard at that job. But the other thing about the concrete crew evidence is that the three plaintiffs who worked on the concrete crew provided evidence not saying wherever we went, we saw harassment. What they said is they were harassed on the concrete crew. But the concrete crew is not a construction site. So when the judge certified a class relating to 262 sites, the concrete crew is not a site. So it isn't even covered by the class that she certified. Ultimately, the scope of the plaintiff's anecdotes is too limited in time and too limited in place. All of the evidence of the anecdotes that they submitted happened before the middle of 2002. The EEOC report even earlier, and it only covered, the only site it covered in harassment is Skybridge. The plaintiff's own individual evidence, which I would submit is not adequate to demonstrate an environment, was all over with by mid-2002 because they were all gone from the company. Finally, the plaintiffs attached about a quarter or half-inch stack of random charges to their reply in support of class certification that describes isolated incidents at different work sites that went in the later years of the class period, although I don't think it went beyond 2007. But none of those really could even possibly describe a pervasive hostile environment. In addition, of course, as is obvious by now from what I've been saying, of the 262 sites, 261 of them aren't really covered in any substantial detail at all. For that reason, Your Honors, we ask that the district court's rulings on both classes be reversed.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Curry.
Good morning, judges. May it please the court, Peter Curry on behalf of the plaintiff, appellees, and the class. The crux of Walsh's appeal with regard to the hours and overtime class centers on the application of Dukes to the specific facts of this case. Walsh hyperextends the...
On the application of what? Maybe you should speak.
I'm sorry, the application of the Walmart case, Dukes.
Why?
The Dukes case.
The Dukes case.
Why start by referring to the case rather than to Rule 23? It's Rule 23 that we need to apply, and the difficulty, the challenge that's being made here is that there isn't adequate commonality here. Now, why is there adequate commonality? Forget about Walmart. Forget even about Falcon. Why is there enough commonality when it apparently is agreed between the parties that the on-site supervisors are making independent decisions?
Well, the commonality comes from, in part, this idea that the managers, the low-level managers, do move from site to site to site. And there are a number of overt racists that have...
But there's no evidence that these four supervisors have been at all 262 sites.
Correct. There is no evidence that they've been at all 262 sites, but, for instance, let's take Robert DeBoer, who is the manager of this concrete crew. They would have been at the majority of these sites, and that's both building and heavy highway, because they pour concrete everywhere. And so...
Well, what I don't understand, the concrete man, the superintendent, who was actually the one who got Kuna fired, didn't he? Wasn't it?
No, he was not.
Wasn't the head of the concrete team?
No, it was another person named John Tahaney.
Pardon?
John Tahaney, another alleged.
So this concrete team, and do you agree with Mr. Bertocchi it has 7 to 10 people on it?
That sounds approximately right. I think it fluctuates. I think it can go up to 15, depending on...
So this team goes from site to site. Suppose it goes to all 262 sites. Does the person who runs the team, who's the bigot, we'll say, alleged bigot, does he then abuse other workers at the site, or is he just with his little team? Maybe he abuses the black members of the team, but that would just be three people, apparently. Is he broadcasting, so to speak, to the other people on the site?
Sure. According to the plaintiffs, he is, in the testimony that
I don't really see that. He's doing his concrete stuff. Is it the concrete people are working with other workers while they're pouring their concrete or whatever they do?
Well, they certainly work around other workers, including other parts of the general laborers. General labor, the concrete crew will pour concrete, but general laborers will do things like strip and chip and do other things to assist the concrete crew. And so they are working in very close proximity. And the testimony...
So what is the... what is the evidence that the head of this concrete crew talks to the other workers, the people who aren't in his crew, and, you know, says these makes these racist comments?
Sure. And the testimony from the plaintiffs is that he openly and commonly refers to black employees, not just laborers, but black employees, as lazy and dirty compared to whites and Hispanics.
So the people who testified to this, are they talking about this early period in the complaint, these early days, or about later, or what?
Well, they're talking about their experiences. All of the plaintiffs in this case were gone by sometime in 2002.
Well, what's the basis then for having a class that includes later workers?
Well, the basis would be, Your Honor, that even after this evidence came out, and it's sort of important to note that one of the other managers, John Tahaney, testified that that Robert DeBoer, the manager of the concrete division, may well have used the word nigger at the workforce, but that he didn't use it in ways that were an affront to people. And when the EEOC questioned Robert DeBoer about whether or not he used the word nigger at the workforce, his response was, I can't remember. And I think that certainly, you know, we can read between the lines and draw an inference between those two statements that he did use that kind of language at the workforce. And the fact that this was all part of the EEOC's investigative memorandum, which was comprehensive.
Was Mr. Badaki correct when he suggests there are about 700 people in the class?
That would be approximately correct
for the hours class. And for the hostile work environment class, how many?
We don't have that information yet, but obviously somewhere in excess of 700. I think that you know, we're safely between 700 and potentially 2,000, based on the number of employees that they employ at any given time during a calendar year.
As many as 2,000, you say?
It could be upwards of 2,000, but unfortunately we don't have that data.
What evidence is there that would enable anyone to figure out how many of these people were actually affected by this language, this abuse?
I think in terms of pinning down an exact number of, you know, who was affected by the racially, you know, derogatory comments, I think that may be difficult to do short of deposing them.
Well, what would the litigation look like exactly if it went ahead, just focused on the hostile work environment? So there would be what? There would be a determination of whether the supervisor, these foremen, and the am I right? There are three foremen and a superintendent.
Correct.
Okay. So there'd be a factual inquiry into what these people had said. Is that
there would Judge, but you know,
and when they had said it, presumably.
Pardon me.
What they had said and when they had said it. Would that be the focus of this initial determination of whether there was hostile language?
An overarching hostile work environment at Walsh. You know, I think that certainly that could be part of an inquiry, but there's also, you know, a lot of other evidence aside from just, you know, Robert DeBoer or Skybridge and Park Place. As Judge Lefko noted, there have been several hangman noose incidents, which are, you know, sort of at the top of the offensive list. And they happened at the Millennium Park site.
Suppose that there was a determination that a hostile work environment had been created, but you still wouldn't know how many of these 2,000 workers had been affected by it.
Sure. Well, you know, and I think...
I mean, what if there's a fellow who worked on a Walsh project for one day in this complaint period, and he heard, you know, one of these words? Would he wouldn't be entitled to relief.
Well, you know, it certainly would depend on, I guess, the facts and circumstances that happened, you know, exactly to him. But I think that the issue with regard to the hostile work environment class is that there's sort of this totality of circumstances.
But then you'd have 2,000 separate hearings?
No, we wouldn't have 2,000 separate hearings. I think that the way it would...
Because it's completely... It's totally unknown at this stage how many of these people were victimized.
Well, sure, but I think, you know, I mean, looking at, you know, past cases and stuff...
I mean, if you spend one day at a workplace and heard a bad word, you're not going to be able to obtain damages for a hostile work environment. That's ridiculous.
Sure. Right, and I certainly understand that point, but I think that there would be, you know, based on some prior cases, there certainly have been
It seems totally unworkable. Why wouldn't it be better to just say, well, if a worker like these named plaintiffs, if they think they're victims of a hostile work environment, they bring a lawsuit.
Well, they did, Judge, but I think this gets back to this whole idea of, you know, it's not just one piece of evidence, but it's sort of this entire mosaic that, builds the hostile work environment. It's the comments that are made by...
No, I'm worried about what the relief is.
Well, certainly, you know, I think that certainly...
These are birds of passage. They come and work for this contractor one day and someone else some other day. Is there any reason to think that a significant fraction of these 2,000 were victimized?
Well, yes, because I think that the person that comes and works for a day would be the exception and not the norm. Typically, people are hired, these laborers are hired to work on a job, and they work on that job for several months. And then they might get to move to transfer to another job, or they might get laid off.
Why not have a class defined by people who had worked on a Walsh project for a month or more, say?
That could be, you know, a reasonable way to address that issue.
But that isn't no effort was made to narrow it from all the people who ever worked on the site.
But I think it's hard to draw, you know, sort of a bright line test and say that. I don't think you can conclusively say that somebody who worked there for a day, as a matter of law, could not have experienced a hostile work environment if he came in and he saw a noose and then he was called.
But of course, once you say that, you say, well, we don't really know what happened to any class member, and then you're in the point that we're going to need 2,000 hearings, raising the question how this could conceivably be practicable as a class action.
Sure.
Let me ask Judge Posner's question in a different way. I've always understood Title VII to separate the world into individual suits, what happened to me, and pattern or practice suits. You're essentially making a pattern or practice claim, but under the statute, pattern or practice suits are supposed to be brought by the Attorney General. And there could be relief for everybody in a pattern or practice suit, and it might create, if there's liability, it would create a fund, and it could then be distributed. Why is a class action at all appropriate in a world where the statute authorizes pattern or practice litigation?
Well, you know, the statute also authorizes, although there are a lot of similarities between a pattern and practice case, there is also hostile work environment claims. And those cases, there have been many of them before, you know, this one came around. This isn't, you know, certainly isn't the first hostile work environment claim. And those same arguments would apply equally to those prior cases.
It doesn't seem to lend itself to class action. Another alternative, what about why not just go to the EEOC and say, you know, bring a suit and enjoin this behavior if that's what's going on, right? The damages are inconsequential on an individual basis. Why wouldn't this be a good project for the EEOC, right?
Well, we would have loved to have the EEOC to have taken the case, but unfortunately
they don't do that.
They didn't. Yeah, they didn't do it, and so we were left to prosecute it ourselves. I'm sorry,
Mr. Curry.
Yeah.
You suggest that the transfer of the managers permeate the Chicago area workforce with discrimination and harassment.
Correct.
What is the basis of that? Where will I find the evidentiary support for the transfer policy?
Sure. Well, the basis for that statement is that, for instance, obviously, as we already talked about, the traveling concrete crew and the head of that.
Well, is it your position the concrete crew infects everything?
In part. I mean, it's
one part. When you say in part, I appreciate there are traveling phenomena within the superstructure of the company.
Correct.
But are you suggesting that's just enough that this crew, because it may touch base over an extended period of time with all the 262 sites, is sufficient?
No,
for
I'm
the
not
commonality?
Saying. Right. I'm not saying in and of itself it's sufficient. What I'm saying is it is a piece, a part of that mosaic. And there are many other pieces from the obvious, all of the things that came out of a couple of the projects, the Skybridge and Park Place projects. Also, you know, one of the other alleged bigots in this case is a guy named Robert Kuna, who worked at least 13 different Walsh sites. And he was a known racist for years. In fact, John Tahaney, who was another Walsh manager, testified that before he ever even worked with him, he knew that he was a racist because everybody else knew. It was common knowledge. And so after he worked with him, his testimony was every other word out of his mouth was nigger. And so when you've got a guy like that working from going from site to site to site, that also is another piece of the mosaic that will lend itself to this hostile work environment. The nooses that show up at these job sites is another piece of the mosaic that lends itself to hostile work environment. There's also this understanding there among many of the
black... Thank you, counsel. Pardon? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. McCutcheon?
Just a couple corrections of myself and of Mr. Curry. Mr. Tahaney is the guy who got Mr. Kuna fired for using the N-word.
Tahaney,
T-A-H.
Oh, right. And what was his job?
He was a supervisor. He was a superintendent because I think
he was a superintendent.
Yes. Judge Posner, I want to correct something I said to Judge Posner. There is no hiring hall, in fact, in these situations. The laborers apply directly to Walsh for a job on a particular site, which I guess suggests to me that if things weren't very good at Walsh, they'd apply to another company.
They apply for a project?
There's probably a posting, and they have to be union members if it's a union job, right, which I think all of them in Chicago in this area are. And they apply. They go to Walsh and put in an application.
So that's because they're not daily workers.
No.
They're not,
With respect to the concrete crew, some aspects of that. The concrete crew, first, only is part of the building division. It doesn't work on the stuff on the highway side of the house. It doesn't hit every job. On many jobs, Walsh doesn't self-perform concrete. They hire a concrete subcontractor. There is nothing in the record about the concrete crew that indicates there were any hostile interactions outside of the crew. The three crew members said we were harassed working on the crew, but there's no evidence that that spread to any of the jobs they visited, which certainly would not be anywhere near all 262 jobs. And those brief visits, we would submit, cannot create a hostile environment. If there's nothing further, mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And the court will be in recess.